So you know Shakespeare's rule, right? First thing we do is kill all the lawyers. Hey, but wait, it's the lawyers who are saving the world. That's right, lawyers are marching through the heat and dust of Pakistan to save democracy. What's wrong with this picture? Not a thing. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 11th, and we're keeping the lawyers alive in this hour. Also looking ahead at the Republican strategy and Democratic loyalty, floodwaters attacking homes in the Midwest, authorities cracking down on immigration in the heartland, and proving the existence of viral marketing. Well, it's harder than you think. That and all the news. President Bush met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel this morning as he continues his final European tour. Key issues they talked about included global warming, which the president addressed yesterday.
I think we can actually get an agreement on global climate change during my presidency. Just so you know.
Just so you know, the president is also talking this trip about Iran. He says his first choice is to solve a nuclear standoff diplomatically, but all options are on the table, he said, including the possibility of a military strike.
Residents along the Mississippi River are preparing for what could be the worst flooding since 1993. In Cedar Falls, Iowa, officials are making evacuation plans as the Cedar River threatens to spill over a levee. Swollen streams and rivers are also threatening towns in Indiana, Wisconsin, and Illinois.
Yesterday, Senate Democrats failed to push through a proposal to tax windfall profits of the five largest oil companies. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says everywhere you go, people are talking about the record high price of gas.
We have a comprehensive plan to deal with it, both short term and long term. And they don't even want to debate it.
Republicans argue the new taxes would stifle production. The measure failed with 51 votes, 9 short of the 60 needed to pass. Investigators in Sudan's capital are looking for clues to why an airliner veered off a runway and burned after landing in a thunderstorm last night. More than 40 people are dead or missing, but about 171 people escaped the burning plane.
In Pakistan, a U.S. airstrike has killed 11 Pakistani troops and 8 pro-Taliban militants on the Afghan border. The Pakistan military charges that the attack was unprovoked and cowardly. The Los Angeles Lakers came home. Game 3 of the NBA Finals, they beat the Boston Celtics 87-81. Celtics won 2 in Boston and still hold a 2-1 lead in the best-of-7 series.
Oil has edged up slightly in Asian trading today to $132 a barrel. The Dow closed up 9 points to 12,289. The S&P closed at 1358, and the NASDAQ dropped 10 points to 2448.
We're going to be talking about Republican strategy and Democratic loyalty later on in the hour. We want to know, what is the price of disloyalty in your life? To the victor go the spoils. The Clinton camp is trying to figure out who was with them and who was agin them. If someone's agin you, if someone's disloyal to you, what's the price in your life? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Again?
877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, for a Guinness. Your fur a Guinness. Come on.
I just gotta
That's how it works. It's America. America, come
now,
on.
Now, my favorite story today. The founder of Google wants to go to space.
He wants to
be on a space flight.
Well, he can afford it. If you want to go to space with Google, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This morning we're following two rapidly developing stories out of Pakistan. A fatal clash at the Pakistan-Afghanistan border has reportedly involved U.S.-led forces. More on that in a moment. Also today, a motorcade of tens of thousands of protesting lawyers is making its way from the central city of Multan to the country's capital, Islamabad.
Chief Tere Jaan Nisar! Chief Tere Jaan Nisar!
Those are chants from the Pakistani lawyers demanding that officials reinstate more than 60 judges that President Pervez Musharraf sacked last year. They're also demanding that Pervez step down. The BBC's Barbara Plett is there for coming to us from Islamabad. And Barbara, good morning. Let's start with the border clash. Any more details on what happened there?
Well, it's still quite a confused picture, but what seems to have happened in general terms is that Afghan forces backed by U.S. air power were battling with Taliban militants near the Afghan-Pakistan border. And in that process, a Pakistani border post manned by Pakistani soldiers was hit and 11 of them were killed. And we've just recently had the statement now from the Pakistan Army very strongly condemning it. I mean, the wording, I think, is probably the strongest I've seen since I've been here. Twice they refer to the airstrike as an act of aggression.
And what do you take away from that very strong language?
Well, I mean, 11 of the soldiers, 11 of their own, have been killed. So that's why you get the fury. But I think also you've been seeing increasing tensions between Pakistan and America over what to do about the Taliban in this very nebulous border area. And you're seeing two different views of how to deal with them. If you look at the Pakistani strategy, it seems their priority right now is peace within Pakistan. They're trying to make peace with the militants so those militants don't attack them inside Pakistan. And if you read between the lines, it looks as if they don't really believe it's possible to seal this border in the kind of way the Americans are demanding to prevent these same militants from going across and attacking the Americans. The Americans, on the other hand, seem to be more and more ignoring Pakistani sensibilities and just going into the tribal areas, hitting Al-Qaeda and Taliban targets without coordinating with the army. So I think there is perhaps not a fundamental breach, but there is differing views more and more of how to deal with the situation.
Okay, Barbara, we're certainly going to keep a watch on that story and those tensions, which, as you said, have existed for some time. And perhaps we're just seeing then that language, some really strong reaction to what happened today. To the protest, how is the government reacting to tens of thousands of lawyers blocking the main roads and making their way to Islamabad?
Well, this is really interesting because this lawyers' movement grew up last year in protests against actions taken by the president, Pervez Musharraf, in which he sacked 60 judges during emergency rule. Now you've had a newly elected government, democratically elected, with parties that said they would restore those judges. But that hasn't happened yet. And so the lawyers are saying, well, we've given you enough time. We're going to revive our movement. And now we're marching in a way against you. I mean, they do talk about President Musharraf, but they're also saying it's really Parliament that we're speaking to. Get off your chairs and restore these judges. And I think that the new government led by Benazir Bhutto's party, the Pakistan People's Party, is very worried because they are now becoming the kind of focus in this conflict that Musharraf was last year.
Barbara, it seems to me there's something counterintuitive about lawyers taking such a heroic role here. I mean, you think of them as kind of post-colonial functionaries in Pakistan, but they've really sort of become a symbol of the opposition. Do Pakistanis see it that way?
Yeah, many of them do, I think. I mean, the key thing that happened that sparked this movement was that the Chief Justice last year, about a year ago, President Musharraf dismissed him. And he stood up to the president while he was still in army uniform. You had a judge standing up to the army. I mean, people hadn't seen that before. And that really inspired these lawyers. And so they have moved ahead with this, with their protest, saying that they're actually fighting for the rule of law. Against a dictator at that time, as they said it, but now against a parliament that's not acting. And they certainly set the political agenda last year. They were the kind of key momentum, I think, behind the events that weakened President Musharraf. So what we're looking at now is whether they can revive that momentum or whether they're a spent force. We'll have to see exactly what they can achieve with this second coming.
Barbara, I actually talked to a Pakistani lawyer last week, and he said exactly the same thing, which is it was just simply happenstance that the lawyers felt they had to get involved after the Supreme Court justice was dethroned. Finally, a last question. A weekend, Pervez Musharraf insists he's not going to resign and that he's not going to reinstate the judges. How weak is he?
He's become pretty isolated since February elections in which his political allies were soundly defeated and in which two political parties came to power who were his opponents. Now, it looked very bad at that time, but he seems to be quite a survivor. And there have been splits in the coalition, particularly over these judges for various reasons. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the two main coalition partners do not quite see eye to eye on how to deal with President Musharraf. One partner says he should be impeached. The other says, no, we don't really want any destabilizing confrontations. So they're going slowly. And Musharraf is hoping that this split will widen and that he can benefit from it.
Thank you. Barbara Plett, BBC correspondent, reporting from Islamabad.
We're going to shift focus and talk about the campaign. It's no longer a cliffhanger, but it certainly is a daily story. Both candidates, John McCain on the Republican side and Barack Obama on the Democratic side, were talking about the economy yesterday, and there are likely to be more headlines today as this campaign continues on to November. Joining us now is Mike Duncan, who's the chairman of the Republican National Committee. Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thank you.
Let me begin with the tough question first. With a lot of, at least on paper, negatives, low approval rating for the Republican incumbent, and a lot of divisive language, it seems, coming from conservatives in the public media and in the sort of chattering class, I'm wondering if, I mean, how would you answer the charge that McCain 2008 is looking like a repeat of Dole 96?
Well, I think that's absolutely ludicrous to talk about that. Look, we have we're disappointed in 2006. We're making midterm corrections. We've got a great candidate who represents the center right of this country, which is the majority of this country. The conservatives are coming together. We've in the last 90 days, we've had a great opportunity to bring the party together while the Democrats were still fighting. I have over 800,000 individuals who've donated to the campaign so far. Our fundraising is far ahead of our budget. All the signs are there. 9 out of 10 Republicans in the polling that we're seeing are supporting John McCain. We're getting a substantial number of Democrats on the other side. You look at in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia and Kentucky, we're getting, in some instances, 1 out of 3 of those who voted for Senator Clinton. We feel very good about where we're positioned for the fall campaign.
All right, Mike. Well, listen to this. This is from Steve Hildebrand, who's the deputy national director of Barack Obama's campaign, talking about some other states that you didn't mention on that list.
Well, I think there's a lot of potential out there. Louisiana, Georgia, North Carolina, Arkansas. You know, there's a lot of opportunity out there. And, you know, we're at the early stages of this. And we think there's going to be potential in places all over the country.
Now, that's the view from Barack Obama's campaign. Mike Duncan of the RNC. Do you think the Democrats have a southern strategy this year?
Well, I think if they do, they're going to come up really short. The values of the Republican Party of lower taxes, less government, individual responsibility, and a strong national defense play well throughout the entire country. And when you take the list that he was talking about, Louisiana, where we just elected the Bobby Jindal, one of the great young governors of this country last year, and he's doing a wonderful job there. Georgia, where we have a Republican governor. North Carolina, where we're making a tremendous attempt this time to get the governor.
But what do you make of the setbacks in Mississippi? What do you make of the setback in Mississippi?
Well, obviously, I was disappointed. I think we had Louisiana and Mississippi. We had three races, and people thought they elected three conservatives to Congress. Unfortunately, they only elected one Republican conservative. The Democrats ran far to the right. In fact, in Mississippi, Childers ran away from Barack Obama, and I think that's the strategy that you're going to see other Democrat candidates in the South take.
Mike, what do you make of former Speaker Newt Gingrich's suggestion that the Republicans, for one reason or another, have lost the reform mantle, and unless they retake it from the Democrats, they're going to lose in November?
Well, I think we have absolutely the right person at the right time running as president of the United States with John McCain. Look at his 20-year record in the Congress. He has been a reformer. There's not been anyone who's been stronger on earmarks. John McCain was able to put together the coalition that allowed us to appoint judges to this country, to the Supreme Court. He's led in bipartisan reforms. John McCain has been a maverick. He's been someone who's worked across the aisle. He's capable of making decisions.
He's not necessarily a maverick on the war. With the unpopular war in Iraq, do you think that's going to stick between now and November?
Well, I beg to differ. John McCain is the one who came up with the idea for the surge and pushed that forward. And look at the results. It's not on the front page now because we're having good results in Iraq, and he had the courage to stand up and say, this is what we need to do.
Mike Duncan, tough questions this morning, but thanks so much for joining us on The Takeaway. Mike Duncan is the chairman of the Republican National Committee, speaking to us from Washington. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So, how are your allergies today? How are they doing?
Actually, they're fine. Thanks for asking.
You're not sounding so viral.
I know, sometimes.
That actually has no meaning in this century.
It doesn't?
Yeah, well, you used to say viral, or if you even did say viral, you were evoking notions of a global pandemic, viruses causing people to get sick all around the world.
But I thought you were going to ask me about the 21st century.
No. In the 21st century, viral means something very, very different. That's right. That's a part of being in the 21st century. Viral today, of course, comes from computer virus, which then comes from things that are viral, things like this. That, of course, is the viral video that went huge. I've got a crush on Obama. Barack Obama had nothing to do with it, but he probably benefited from the fact that over 8 million people watched it on YouTube. You saw it, right?
I did.
Yeah. But viral videos are all about something that starts really, really small, goes on the internet, and through distribution one way or another become really, really huge. The I've got a crush on Obama video is one. The guy stuffing the Mentos in the Diet Coke. Did you see that one? That's another one.
Burger King and their chicken sandwich.
Marketers are trying to take advantage of viral phenomena to push their products. But the question is, are viral emails as widespread as the numbers suggest? Should there be more successes than there are? Well, there are people actually studying this. Steven Strogatz, do we know who these people are who are responsible for making something viral?
Yeah, good morning. Well, we don't really know who's responsible. That's often the problem with ordinary viruses, too. I mean, it took a lot of work for the epidemiologists to trace back to patient zero in the AIDS epidemic.
Well, it's interesting. You're a mathematician at Cornell University, professor of applied mathematics, and you set out to determine whether the idea of viral marketing, which we talk about a lot here in the 21st century, is actually as similar to the actions of a biological virus or even a computer virus. Tell me how you designed your research and what you discovered.
Well, let me first make clear, I'm acting here as a reporter. This is work done by my colleague, John Kleinberg, in computer science at Cornell, and also David Libin-Nowell at Carleton College. So in a paper that they published a few weeks ago, they tried to find examples of viral behavior that left a trace. I mean, that's one of the difficulties in trying to understand word of mouth or other viral processes, that they don't really leave any signature or any mark. But they found two examples that did, which were there was a petition you may remember a few years ago about probably ended up in your own inbox to try to oppose the impending Iraq war. This was in late 2002.
Right.
So this was alleged to be from the United Nations was collecting signatures to then send to President Bush to tell him don't go to war. In fact, it turned out to be a hoax, but the people who were getting the petition and then signing it and forwarding it to their friends didn't think it was a hoax. So this was a good study. I mean, this was a way to see how things circulate through the internet. And the surprise was that it's not really viral in the way that you would think of for a computer virus or a real virus.
So it doesn't spread indiscriminately. It follows patterns that are in many ways easy to discern. What kind of patterns?
Well, see, the surprise here is that when you think viral, with that analogy, you would imagine since we know that we're all just the famous 6 degrees of separation apart from each other.
Right.
That really is true. Social networks are like that. So you would think if that were the case that the petition should have landed in your inbox after only 6 or 7 or just a handful of signatures. But that isn't true. What you found is that there would be hundreds of intermediaries between you and the source of this petition. So that was sort of a paradox that these researchers were trying to understand.
And there's
the small world.
And these are more peer networks than they are sort of indiscriminate kind of mathematical patterns that grow exponentially, right?
Right. That's a very good point. These are peer networks.
People's friends.
After all, friendship networks.
Right.
It's whoever you would choose to send some political message to.
But isn't there an inherent assumption in there that, of course, if it's a friend of yours, it's someone who thinks exactly like you do, as opposed to people who have friends of all different kinds of persuasions?
Right. That's a good point, that there's a kind of incestuous aspect to social networks that wouldn't necessarily be true in the case of, you know, if you're sneezing on the bus and spreading viruses that way. You can spread it to people of all walks of life and all persuasions. But with social contagion, it tends to stay kind of in your circle or among like-minded people, and therefore the spreading is a lot slower.
Occasionally things break out. Did you see the video of those guys stuffing the Mentos in the Diet Coke and watching them explode?
Yeah.
I actually talked to those guys a little while ago, and they described that they posted their film on YouTube, and within like hours from Saturday to Monday, they were on asked to be on the Leno show. I mean, that went viral really, really quickly. How does that break the mold based on the research of your colleagues?
Well, then, of course, it's a little trickier when we start talking about the purely viral thing spreading from link to link on the internet or through friends. Once you hit broadcast, I mean, that's not viral. That's traditional propagation, right? Sort of top-down, centralized message sending.
But to get to Leno, millions of people had to circulate.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So this research is not intended to say that things aren't viral, because certainly there are all sorts of viral, as you say, viral videos and messages. The trick is to try to, as scientists, put numbers on these processes. How do they really work? How do they differ from biological viruses?
And despite the successes of some of the things that we referred to and the Obama video that we played at the top, it's actually harder than you think to start something viral and have it be huge in any way, right?
That's exactly the point. I mean, that's the thing that marketers and advertisers are trying to do all the time, or political campaigns. I mean, if it were that easy to start grassroots movements or to have sleeper hits, that, you know, movies that catch on, well, they'd be more common than they are. So no one really understands how viral things work, and that's part of what this research is directed to address.
When he sneezes on a bus, it's in Ithaca, New York. Stephen Strohgatz is a professor of applied mathematics at Cornell University. Thanks, Steve. And now more headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thanks, John. 29 minutes past the hour. President Bush has been meeting with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel this morning. The president touched on a number of international issues, including saying that diplomacy is the first choice to solve the Iran standoff, but all options are open. He also said that he's looking not to have permanent US bases in Iraq, and also saying that it would be disastrous for the world economy even if protectionism stopped free trade. We called our BBC colleague in Germany to find out what the president and Angela Merkel are doing right now, and apparently they're having lunch. Finally, to a story about a Kansas City man who accidentally fired a 2.5-inch nail into the top of his head while working in a back garden. He says he feels
a nail?
Fine.
A nail.
Yes. He says he feels fine now, but George Chandran says he and a friend were working when the nail suddenly disappeared.
He asked me, he says, did you see where that nail went? And I said, no, I don't. But I said, I've got just a little sting here.
Chandler says he's very lucky to be alive.
Oh my God.
If you're wondering what happened next, they took the nail out with a claw hammer.
Plenty of room
the
there
two
for
of
the
them
nail in his head.
Together?
Yep.
Thanks, Femi.
Ouch.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, this is Troy Erickson calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I don't believe in penalizing disloyalty, I believe in forgiveness. But I will take you off the Christmas card list, so if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.
That's an answer to our question of what does loyalty mean to you? Thanks very much for that. And if you have a story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And now on to immigration concerns. Monday, President Bush issued an executive order requiring federal contractors to verify their employees' legal working status. But more and more frequently, state officials, frustrated by the federal government's efforts, have been cracking down on their own. John Day, co-owner of Panhandle Growers in Florida, knows about these efforts firsthand. Welcome, John.
Welcome. Thank you.
I understand the sheriff deputies, they showed up at your tree business, and what happened?
They took 13 of our employees.
And they told you, did they explain why?
I wasn't right there in the office when the lead man came up. I was out in the field and saw some of the vehicles on the perimeter of the field.
You had documentation for these men who were taken away. Describe what your feeling was about the paperwork you had.
Well, that's part of the problem is we had I-9s and Social Security, copies of Social Securities, and in some cases resident alien cards on file.
And so you felt there was some question in your mind as to whether or not they were legal or illegal immigrants, but for the most part you had the paperwork, right?
Well, we had what we believed was required by all the information that we read out of government documents on employees.
Also joining us is Damian Cave, the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times, who's been tracking these local immigration crackdowns. And Damian, it sounds like a lot of frustration and confusion. Is this common, what John Davey has experienced?
Well, what I've found is that around the country, there's a lot of pressure being put on local sheriffs to do something about illegal immigration. And this is sometimes in communities that have large increases over the past few years, but not necessarily serious problems associated with illegal immigration. You know, in this area, in John Davey's area, for example, there weren't guys on corners. The sheriff couldn't show me an increase in crime or anything that was associated with that. This was, according to many people in the community, an effort to do something based on an increase in complaints in an election year.
And what do you think is motivating those complaints if there seems to be no real consequence for the number of illegal immigrants in these communities?
Well, it's a mix of things. One is the economy is down, and so people often look to illegal immigrants as someone who's taking a job, whether they have evidence of that or not. At the same time, as this has become a national debate, some of the cultural and legal issues have become more prominent. You know, a lot of people I've heard complain about the language issue. You know, they really feel that these people who come, and if they don't speak English, somehow they're of, you know, lesser value or less willing to assimilate to American culture. And so a lot of the pressure is a mix of economic complaints and cultural complaints about fears of this group of community, this group of Latinos in particular, that won't assimilate. Again, in many cases, there isn't evidence of that. This is just a very emotional response, in part that's based on fears about the economy and fears about culture.
Damian, let me throw a number out to you. 1,562 bills related to illegal immigration were filed in 2007. 240 of those became law in states. We're not talking about proposals at the national level.
Well, this speaks to this trend where, because Congress has remained relatively inactive on revising immigration law, states and local police enforcement have been forced to act or feel that they're forced to act. So you have these laws growing all over the country, in Mississippi and Oklahoma, most recently just in the past week in South Carolina, that do things like make it illegal to transport illegal aliens. So the concern in some cases is, well, if I'm just driving a bunch of guys, I have no idea if they're legal or illegal to church or to work or to the beach, does that make that person a criminal?
Right.
And many of these laws do criminalize that. So it's a serious change in terms of how immigration used to be treated as a civil offense. And at the state and local level,
as
it's
a
becoming much
offense.
More criminalized.
John Davey, final question. What would you like to see happen? You're a little frustrated that Congress hasn't acted.
Yes, I think that's where the decision needs to be made, so it's uniform across the board in every city, county, state, municipality, so that it's all the same everywhere.
And everyone's clear about what is legal activity and what is illegal activity.
You know, it seems to me in our day of technology that we can identify people by fingerprinting and voice printing without a problem. So we know who everybody is and where they are and if they're working, and obviously there is a need.
Thank you, John Davey, co-owner, Panhandle Growers in Florida. And thank you also to Damian Cave, Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And now it's time for more headlines from Femi Okey. Femi?
Thanks, Adore. 22 minutes to the hour. President Bush is in Germany today. He says that diplomacy is the best bet to address the standoff over Iran's nuclear development. But all options are on the table if Iran continues its uranium enrichment program. The home court advantage is holding. Game 3 of the NBA Finals was in Los Angeles last night, and the Lakers beat the Boston Celtics 87-81. Also holding are the levees on the Cedar River in Iowa. The town of Cedar Rapids feared the worst, but so far the town has remained relatively dry. It's only one of several towns in the Midwest threatened by flooding, and more rain is predicted for tomorrow. Some developing news out of Baghdad. The US military says they've detained a bomb expert who was trained by Iran, and he's believed to have numerous Iranian contacts who've helped him smuggle weapons into Iraq. In Sudan, investigators are looking for clues as to why a passenger jet veered off a runway in a thunderstorm and burst into flames last night. We're on the line now with BBC's Amber Henshaw in Khartoum, Sudan. Amber, the pictures of the crash were amazing. It didn't even look like there would be possibly any survivors whatsoever, but people walked away from the crash. How are they doing?
That's right. The scenes were very, very dramatic. The flames engulfed the entire plane. I've just come back from the airport now, and I was able to get quite a good look at the wreckage. The plane has basically broken into two halves. The tail looks reasonably intact, but the front part, the cockpit, is basically destroyed, completely destroyed. The Civil Aviation Authority now say that they believe 177 people managed to walk away, which I think when you saw the pictures of the flames followed by the destruction that's left, it's extraordinary they managed to escape. 29 people were killed in the accident, and we gather that 13 people are still missing.
Where could the missing people be, Amber?
It's very difficult to tell. The picture here has been very confused. Different bits of information come from different sources. The Civil Aviation Authority believe that some people managed to escape from the wreckage and then possibly just left the airport compound, possibly trying to make their way home. And they're trying to track those people down so they get a better idea of exactly what happened and what the final death toll is.
Amber Henshaw reporting for us from the BBC in Khartoum, Sudan. Thank you very much indeed. And Amber was talking about the plane crash in Sudan last night, where the plane apparently touched down safely and then burst into flames. We will bring you more information on that story as it develops over the next couple of days.
That was quite an inferno. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Here's a question. How do you apologize for something that is so devastating that it's really difficult to imagine any kind of apology? It's actually a question in the news today as the Prime Minister of Canada prepares at this hour to offer an apology to the Native people of Canada later today. More about that in a moment. But what is the historical record on big apologies?
As Prime Minister of Australia, I am sorry. On behalf of the government of Australia, I am sorry. On behalf of the Parliament of Australia, I am sorry.
You're listening to a Paul Kelly song. He's an Australian musician. The song is called From Little Things, Big Things Grow. But he's sampled in there, and you can hear it, the Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, who in February of 2008, in an extraordinary historical event, apologized to all Aborigines in Australia for their treatment by the government throughout history. Here's the actual apology Kevin Rudd delivered on February 2008.
We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these our fellow Australians. We apologise especially for the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, their communities and their country.
It was an amazing, candid, and straightforward apology to the Aborigines, thousands of whom watched around the nation to the televised event. He used the word sorry 7 times in the 360-word statement. As for historical apologies, it would be hard to top the one from F.W. de Klerk, who certainly had plenty to say to black South Africans. He was the last state president of apartheid-era South Africa, and here he is in August 1996.
I should like to express my deepest sympathy with all those on all sides who suffered during the conflict. I and many other leading figures in our party have already publicly apologized for the pain and suffering caused by former policies of the National Party. I reiterate these apologies today.
De Klerk eventually became a vice president in the government of national unity under Nelson Mandela, a post he kept till 1996. He and Mandela shared the Nobel Prize in 1996. In 1998, Bill Clinton gave sort of an apology. Here it is.
I have come today to pay the respects of my nation to all who suffered and all who perished in the Rwandan genocide. We did not act quickly enough after the killing began. We cannot change the past, but we can and must do everything in our power to help you build a future without fear.
It was a carefully hedged acknowledgement that the U.S. could have done more, but Clinton didn't apologize for what the U.S. didn't do to stop the Rwandan genocide. But this afternoon, Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper will officially apologize for what First Nation people call the darkest chapter in Canada's history. Here's an apology that's kind of a preamble to all this from Canada's Indian Affairs Minister in January 1998.
The Government of Canada acknowledges the role it played in the development and administration of these schools. We wish to emphasize that what you experienced was not your fault. It should not have happened. To those of you who suffered this tragedy at residential schools, we're deeply sorry.
The residential schools suppressed language and culture of Native people, and the Assembly of First Nations will be listening as the Prime Minister of Canada apologizes at 3 p.m. publicly in Canada.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Wednesday, June 11th. It's another tough day in the Midwest and other parts of the country that have continually been battered by very severe storms, some of the worst in 15 years. From Oklahoma to Connecticut, officials are blaming 15 deaths on the weather, especially the flooding. This morning in Iowa, officials are preparing to evacuate downtown Cedar Falls because they're worried about the Cedar River topping its levee at any time. Close to 4,000 people there have already been displaced by flooding. Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle has declared 30 counties in a state of emergency. The governor joins us right now. Good morning, Governor Doyle. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, give us a sense of what you're battling there in Wisconsin right now.
Well, we have rivers that are far above their crested levels. They're receding a little in the last day, but we have a lot of water in Wisconsin to begin with, a lot of rivers and lakes, and those rivers are really stressed. It means that we have about 64 dams in the area that are being monitored very, very closely. About 19 of those our inspectors suggest are stressed or may present problems, so we're watching those very carefully. We have currently now about 100 people who are in shelters, and we're worried about in the next 48 hours that we may get 2 to 4 more inches of rain that could just go beyond any limits that we could even imagine. So we are really loading up on sandbags, working very, very hard, getting people out of the paths of areas where dams could fail. But having said all of that, in Wisconsin, we're very thankful that as of yet we have not lost any lives or had any serious reported injuries. So people have really pulled together here and gotten through this.
And right now you also have, I understand, some FEMA teams. They are working to assess the flood damage. What kind of steps are they taking?
Well, they are looking to see the damage, the scope of it, and this is all across the southern half of our state, from Lake Michigan and the Lake Michigan shores all the way to the Mississippi River. And they'll be traveling throughout that region, assessing to determine whether we meet various standards. I don't think there's any doubt that we do, and we appreciate the prompt attention FEMA has given to this. But, you know, we need their help to help local governments, to rebuild infrastructure, and obviously there are a lot of people who need some very serious help as well.
Governor, the program, The Takeaway, is heard throughout the state on Wisconsin Public Radio. What is your message for the residents of your state this morning in terms of being as cooperative as they possibly can and not unwittingly getting in the way of some of the rescue efforts?
Well, it's very important to obviously follow. We've had to close a portion of an interstate last night, and last count, I believe, just under 100 roads that are closed. So people really shouldn't test the limits of those and should be careful not to move in areas where they're directed not to go. We also are very thankful people have stepped forward. They've helped out their neighbors. We have a lot of displaced people, but only about 100 in shelters, and that's because neighbors and relatives have stepped forward and really helped out. And in low-lying areas, we are sandbagging like crazy. We have state prisoners who are involved in the effort. We are just trying to do what we can to hold off the waters.
Trying to keep the waters at bay. Jim Doyle, the governor of Wisconsin, we can't thank you enough for taking time out, and we wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Incredible. As you know, we were talking all morning, the people in the Midwest have not seen this kind of flooding ever. I think we heard a story earlier of a 70-year-old couple who were rescued from the roof of their house who'd never seen anything like this in Iowa.
And in fact, we also have talked to some folks in Iowa saying that people over the weekend were on their roofs for an hour, two, yeah, 3 hours, right, waiting for rescuers and boats to come get them.
It's far from New Orleans, but it's looking like New Orleans on the Mississippi River Valley in these days in the Midwest.
It is indeed.
So we have some reaction to our takeaway question, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's one response that we got just within the last hour.
Hi, this is John and Mark heading south on the New Jersey Turnpike. Regarding viral videos, content is the key to it going viral. And the other thing is it's not hard to get on the Jay Leno show. You don't have to touch millions of people. All you have to do is find a producer for the Jay Leno show. That's our take on the takeaway, and now we're off to work.
Thank you very much. That's good. All you have to do is find a producer. That's right.
I wonder how he knows that. How does he know that?
Oh,
that all you have to do is find a producer.
I wonder how many times he's been on the Leno show. Anyway, our focus now is the price of loyalty. We're asking all of you, what is the price of disloyalty in your life? If somebody strays from your loyal sort of network, what do you do to them? To the victor goes the spoils, and that's how it is in the Democratic Party right now. The victor, of course, Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton, not victorious, but certainly putting on a show of unity. But behind the scenes, are there scores being settled? Is that how it works? It's certainly fun to imagine that. Mark Leibovich of the New York Times wrote the political memo story today in the Times. It refers to the idea that those loyal to the Clintons are taking note of those, or that the Clintons are taking note to those who were loyal to them and those who were not loyal. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
How are scores settled in the Clinton world, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it does vary. I mean, the Clintons are known for having thousands, if not tens of thousands, of friends, and you know the term FOB, FO Bill, and FOH, friend of Hillary, was sort of popularized in the 90s. But one of the prices of a long campaign like this is that friends are lost, and certainly a lot of the favors that are called into the Clintons, whether it's a recommendation for one's son-in-law or, you know, having them come raise money for some organization, you know, they're certainly going to be more likely to help people in the future who are with Hillary Clinton's campaign rather than Barack Obama's campaign.
So it's safe to say that Bill Richardson should probably not expect a callback if he should call.
Bill Richardson, he might get a call back, but he might want to hold the phone somewhat far away from his ear.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I think so. I don't think Bill Richardson is is going to be first in line for a cabinet position in any future Hillary Clinton administration.
Well, who's on the list as far as you've been able to tell?
Well, certainly Bill Richardson, certainly a lot of Senator Clinton's colleagues in the Senate, particularly women such as Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, both of whom Senator Clinton has raised money for, has been involved with their campaigns, who went and endorsed Obama. And there are people who worked in the Clinton White House, like Greg Craig, who is an impeachment lawyer, Susan Rice, who worked high up in the State Department, Tony Lake, who was a national security advisor, and numerous others who went with Obama. And, certainly the Clinton people took note of this.
A quick question for you, Mark. I was speaking with some powerful Democrats over the weekend, and they expressed that there is this sense of walking on eggshells and kind of waiting to see what the consequence is going to be for some of them who backed Barack Obama. Did you find that there was a great sense of that, fearful of consequences?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of thing where, time could be a healer of this. Certainly it's a very acute thing right now because the race has ended. And as Joe Andrew, who's another member of the list, he's a former DNC chair who was appointed by Bill Clinton, who was a Clinton superdelegate before becoming an Obama superdelegate, as Joe said to me, your sense of victimization tends to be much greater when you are the victim, when you have lost. So clearly if the Clintons had won or if Hillary Clinton had won, she'd be in a better position to be gracious and forgive faster. But, certainly, these are things that are not forgotten easily or soon. So
who has the longer memory, do you think, quickly, Mark, Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton?
They both have pretty long memories, but probably Bill.
Probably Bill.
Because as a spouse, it's you tend to be more emotional, and Bill's more emotional in general, as he's proven certainly in the course of this campaign.
He's got a long memory himself. Mark Leibovich of the New York Times, who wrote the Political Memo story today in the Times. You should check it out. If you're disloyal to our program, we have ways of finding you, where you are, in your homes, in your communities. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the way to contact us, and you can send your stories at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And we always want to hear from you, Charles. He wrote to us yesterday about the oil conversation with oil expert Lisa Marganelli. And he said to us, look out. The next bubble caused by the same underlying conditions, monopolies and speculation will be food speculation. And with it, millions will die.
Food speculation is actually an important economic and news issue. And we're going to be talking about exactly that on tomorrow's show with Paul Roberts, author of both The End of Oil and The End of Food, two fascinating books. But if you're eating your breakfast this morning, it's not quite the end of food. Think about disloyalty for a moment. What is the price of it in your life? And you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll read your responses on the air tomorrow. MyTake@thetakeaway.org is also the way to email us.
And
what's
so
the price of disloyalty
what is
in,
it?
Your,
in your You already life? Asked me that.
I forgive everyone.
But yeah, I do.
I know. No one's ever loyal to me.
I mean,
people just got to go, Hockenberry, he's nice. We like him. But, when another white guy comes along, on the radio, we'll listen to him too. It's kind
of We're just
like
two forgiving individuals, you and I, or me and you.
It's got to stop, this disloyalty business. I'm serious. It's got to stop. If you can figure out a way of stopping it, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're also on YouTube, iTunes, Facebook.
And
we're going
that.
Viral. We've gone viral.
Have we gone
show.
Viral?
Oh, totally.
When did that happen?
Yeah, we're going to be on Leno tomorrow.
Oh, I'm
Didn't
glad you warned
you?
Me, so
Did
I'll be prepared
yeah.
when I come to work tomorrow.
No. The takeaway.
They neglected.
Going viral with a bullet. Talk to you tomorrow.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.